You are listening to the C19 Podcast, a production by scholars from around the world that explores the past, present, and future through the United States in the long 19th century. In this episode, Paul Thess examines how Martin Delaney articulates anti-slavery discourse by incorporating musical textual references from Joshua McCarter Simpson, a songwriter and activist in Ohio's Colored Conventions movement, and Stephen Foster, a popular minstrel composer, in his novel Blake or the Huts of America. Take a listen, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
At the end of part one of Martin Delaney's novel Blake or the Huts of America, we find the group of self-emancipating characters at the center of this part of the story feeling triumphant, gleeful as they enter free U.S. territory on their way to further freedom in Canada. Thus far, the narrative has primarily followed the path set by Henry Blake as he circumnavigates the U.S. South in his quest to spread his plans for a general strike against the system of enslavement. The end of this section of the novel finds him ushering his family and friends onto Canadian soil. When the group crosses into free U.S. territory, one member, Andy, breaks into the first verses of the song Away to Canada, an anti-slavery hit of sorts along the Underground Railroad circuit in the 1850s. It was reported to have been sung, for example, by fugitives as they crossed from the United States to Canada in Henry Bibb's Voice of the Fugitive. It was sung by Sojourner Truth when she visited Harriet Beecher Stowe's home, and it was reprinted at least twice in The Liberator and circulated in reprints throughout other papers, and it found its way into Delaney's novel. Delaney's citation of this song deserves some attention because it stands as an intriguing musical example of the complex and contradictory cultural references around which this early African-American tale of rebellion is crafted. Delaney only includes a snippet of the song, which begins with the first verse. I'm on my way to Canada, that cold and dreary land, the dire effects of slavery I can no longer stand, and concludes with a remixed version of the chorus. The performance of this song drives a key plot sequence. The entire group of fugitives quickly joins in with Andy, creating a conspicuous performance that sets in motion a series of events involving their discovery by locals who wish to capitalize on the fugitive slave law. Subsequently, the group is chased and captured, and they ultimately escape and successfully cross into Canada West in a scene reminiscent of the one described in Henry Bibb's paper featuring real-life fugitives singing Away to Canada as they leave the U.S. Like many other textual representations of popular and religious music of the time, Delaney gives us this song's lyrics without musical notation. But he departs from the usual workaround for this absence by not pairing these lyrics with a well-known melody, or air, which would enable his readers to understand how the song might sound. In an age when it was expensive to print music and musical literacy was not widespread, it was common practice to explicitly pair a well-known melody with a song. This practice migrated to popular and reform-oriented songbooks from religious hymnals. For example, William Lloyd Garrison's 1841 composition, I Am an Abolitionist, is set to the tune of Auld Lang Syne.
I am an abolitionist, I glory in the name. Though now by slavery's minions hissed and covered o'er with shame.
It is a spell of light and power, the watchword of the free, who spurns it in the trial hour, a craven soul is he.
Despite lacking a melodic reference, Delaney's citation of Away to Canada catches the ear nevertheless. As we read, the lyrics fall into a familiar rhythm that conjures the melody of O Susanna, one of Stephen Foster's most popular and parodied compositions.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Foster is one of the most significant songwriters in the history of American popular music. In fact, he is often understood as the first songwriter in this category. And this success was, in part, established by the blackface performers who sang his songs in the minstrel show. You know the songs because they are still with us. You may remember singing O Susanna or Camptown Races as a child, or seeing Elmer Fudd or Foghorn Leghorn perform these songs in Looney Tunes cartoons. Or maybe you watch the Kentucky Derby every year and notice, as you sip your homemade mint julep, the crowd singing Oh My Old Kentucky Home in their funny hats and seersucker suits. Or being a 19th century Americanist by profession or curiosity, perhaps your favorite AI DJ has streamed one of the numerous recordings of Foster's songs by artists as diverse as Bing Crosby, Mavis Staples, Johnny Cash, James Taylor, and Neil Young. Okay, you get the picture. Delaney uses hymns and other popular music throughout Blake. But given the close association between Stephen Foster's music and the Blackface Minstrel Show, this is a striking element of his musical engagement. Across the decade, Delaney spent writing, revising, and publishing Blake, O Susanna, and other songs written by Foster and taken up by Blackface performers would become standards of the genre. There is yet another layer to this element of Delaney's borrowing and citation. Since Floyd Miller's recovery of Blake in 1970, scholars have identified A Way to Canada and a handful of other songs in the novel as the work of Joshua McCarter Simpson, resident of Zanesville, Ohio, an herb doctor, an activist in Ohio's Colored Conventions movement, a conductor on the Underground Railroad. In fact, he led a state convention concerning this practice in 1858. And with the publication of his original anti-slavery songs in 1852, which included A Way to Canada, he became the first African-American to produce a songbook of original compositions. And actually, as Vicki Eichler points out, since these kinds of songbooks were typically compilations of previously published materials, Simpson's is among the first original songbooks written by any American, white or black. After original anti-slavery songs in 1852, Simpson would continue to publish songs in newspapers, and he collected this work, which included songs from his first book, songs he wrote after the book's publication, along with his personal accounts and several prose parodies satirizing the attitudes of the plantation class, in the more well-known postbellum collection, The Emancipation Car. However odd these sonic associations might ring in our 21st century ears, Delaney and Simpson pick up on the practice of tuning anti-slavery lyrics to popular songs, often ones associated with the minstrel stage. The Hutchinson Family Singers' 1844 song, Get Off the Track, which was set to Dan Emmett's Old Dan Tucker, is probably the most identifiable precursor.
Car emancipation rides majestic through our nation, bearing on its train the story, liberty, our nation's glory. Rolling along, rolling along, rolling along through the nation, freedom's car emancipation. Rolling along, rolling along, rolling along through the nation, freedom's car emancipation.
First of all, the train and... Despite the fact that this was a relatively common practice, we might still wonder why black abolitionists would take up this strategy. Why would Delaney and Simpson, whose work so focused on the elevation of African Americans, invoke a tune that thrived on the lampooning and degrading economy of the minstrel stage? Why would they use a source text so strongly associated with a cartoonish rendering of African American life for an anti-slavery song meant to convey the determined joy of emancipation? The musical textual allusions at play are enhanced by the conspicuous proximity Delaney, Foster, and Simpson operated within along the Pennsylvania-Ohio border. Both Foster and Delaney lived and worked in Pittsburgh, and while evidence that their paths crossed is scant, a number of Foster's biographers highlight the enticing detail that his late father-in-law, Andrew McDowell, was also one of Delaney's mentors and encouraged Delaney, before McDowell's untimely death in 1849, to pursue his ill-fated enrollment in the Harvard Medical School. Joanne O'Connell, in her biography of Foster, writes that Andrew and Delaney met in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, where McDowell fired Delaney's imagination by giving him a copy of Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia, helping to incite the activist attitude he brought to Pittsburgh, where the McDowells also eventually moved. Some scholars have also connected Foster to Pittsburgh's Black Abolitionist Network, which involved, of course, Delaney. Citing Foster's close friendship with abolitionist Charles Shiras, and Shiras's close ties with Charles Avery, who was, according to William Austin, a trusted white abolitionist within Pittsburgh's Black community. Joshua McCarter Simpson is much more obscure than the other two, but he provocatively surfaces here and there in colored convention minutes and newspaper editorials and reprints. He and Delaney were fellow travelers in the Black abolitionist movement. While Foster began publishing some of his most well-known plantation melodies, and Delaney became increasingly involved with abolitionism and the Black press, Simpson was not too far away in Zanesville, Ohio, engaged in similar activities. Working to help establish the political voice of Ohio's large, freed persons of color population through the press, attending and providing music for state conventions, and helping to organize and shepherd escaped enslaved people on their way north. Delaney uses four songs by Simpson, and three of these use Foster melodies. In addition to Away to Canada, Delaney includes The Sun's Reflections, which uses the melody for Foster's song Old Folks at Home, and The Slaveholder's Rest, which uses the melody for Foster's song Uncle Ned. My interest here is in understanding these songs as a way to explore the formation of a Black political aesthetic from within white supremacist antebellum culture. The songs bring together disparate figures, Delaney and Simpson as activists working to end the enslavement crisis, and Stephen Foster writing to satisfy the popular tastes that were being cultivated on the boards of the minstrel stage. Cultural studies theorist Stuart Hall has famously defined the term articulation as a process where aspects of culture that have no necessary inherent relationship to each other coalesce into ideology. As such, focusing on the articulations or linkages that comprise a given ideology is a key method for understanding and undoing its complex formations and expressions, a tool of particular importance for marginalized people and an important aspect of what's going on in Delaney and Simpson's use of these songs. For Delaney and Simpson, music is a method to articulate 19th century anti-slavery activism and popular culture to sow the seeds of a counter-hegemonic discourse, to adopt Henry Blake's phrase, that provides a compelling perspective from which to criticize the status quo and connect Black anti-slavery collectives. With Delaney and Simpson, we see writers who anticipate this theoretical perspective taking apart and cobbling together divergent cultural elements, those of blackface minstrelsy no less, as a way to enter the bloodstream of the discourse about the crisis of enslavement, in service to undoing this dominant ideology and exploring how these songs might bend the popularity of minstrel tunes toward anti-slavery ends. Returning to Away to Canada from this perspective, we hear Simpson's lyrics translating the caricatured, roving, romantic Black figure of Foster's original into a more complex character analogous to the fugitives depicted in Delaney's novel. This fugitive singer strategizes his own emancipation, mulling the impossibility of remaining on the plantation against the unappealing choice of removing to Canada, that cold and dreary land. As is apparent in Delaney's excerpt, the song features an enslaved person thinking through the process of a northward escape. The lyrics to the full song in Simpson's songbook convey the abundance of the fugitive's imagination required to deal with the hard realities he might face, playfully fantasizing about the process. The singer, for instance, enlists none other than Queen Victoria. "I heard Victoria plainly say, if we would all forsake our native land for slavery and come across the lake, that she was standing on the shore with arms extended wide, to give us all a peaceful home beyond the rolling tide. In another verse, his enslaver becomes suspicious of his itchy foot, which prompts the singer to commit to his escape. My heart responded to the charge and thought it was no crime, and something seemed my mind to urge that now's the very time. While the scene in Blake featuring Away to Canada is just one of many references to music in the novel, the parodies of Stephen Foster's songs by Simpson included in Blake raise provocative questions about how Delaney and Simpson stitched together an abolitionist politics that sought to engage and alter the dominant hegemonic discourse of the day. One important way this process, as signified by these songs, figured into the abolitionism Delaney and Simpson register concerns how its various iterations engaged with and steered away from the politics of moral suasion and the aesthetics of sentimentalism, which were and continue to be significant for understanding Delaney's, Foster's, and Simpson's work. By moral suasion, I refer to the political strategy of appealing to individuals' moral sensibilities, as opposed to attempting to enact change through the coercive powers of the state, in order to, as William Lloyd Garrison put it, bring the whole nation to a speedy repentance. Similarly, sentimentalist aesthetics seeks to lead its audiences to common sense, rational conclusions that reinforce social norms by provoking inward emotional responses. Delaney and Simpson articulate an emerging popular culture established on racial grounds with a black radical politics by playing on the 19th century sentimentalist aesthetics that Stephen Foster employed in his blackface minstrel songs. Arising from Protestant music-making practices and preceding reform movements, the temperance movement in particular, music became an important tool in fomenting the kind of right-thinking about the enslavement issue abolitionists pushed. Musical sound was understood as immersive, capable of, as one anti-slavery songwriter put it, quote, exerting upon all classes of society a pure and healthful moral influence. Simpson and Delaney advanced this trend to exploit what philosopher Joao Cacioppo has identified as music's fundamental relationality, its, quote, potential to disrupt sedimented modes of hearing and thinking. Delaney and Simpson used this property of music making in order to create a black abolitionist community that could use a song like Away to Canada as a kind of anthem. As was the case, which I discussed earlier, reported in Henry Bibb's The Voice of the Fugitive, when a large group of formerly enslaved people, after crossing into Canada, spontaneously began singing Simpson's song. Of these three figures, Foster has received the most attention. I don't want to reproduce this disparity, but a few words are in order to frame the textual connection between these men. Widely thought of as America's first composer, Stephen Foster was born in the Pittsburgh area on July 4, 1826, to a middle-class family that struggled to maintain this class position, as Stephen's father struggled with alcoholism, as Stephen himself would later in life. The family became connected to the pro-slavery Democratic Party, an especially strong connection after Foster's sister Eliza married one of James Buchanan's brothers. Foster would go on to write a campaign song for Buchanan. Foster was not formally trained in music, but in what we know about his early musical experiences, we can glimpse the pattern of contradictions that would make his songs so compelling. In a characteristic blend of high and low culture, Foster probably had some musical education from the classically trained German immigrant Henry Kleber and the blackface minstrel performer Dan Rice. Additionally, he gravitated to the sentimental parlor songs of the day. His first published song, Open Thy Lattice Love, is an example of this interest. But he would also hear black church music, which probably consisted of songs more like Methodist hymns than the spirituals we might associate with the black church today, when he accompanied the family's house worker, Olivia Pies, to church. He and his friends would also riff on popular blackface minstrel songs of the day, One imagines O Susanna as a product of one of these sessions. According to Foster biographer Ken Emerson, in the year that followed this song's first recorded performance in 1847, O Susanna proliferated throughout U.S. culture, and the song, with its use of black plantation dialect and comic lyrics, found a special home in the repertoire of blackface groups such as the Sable Harmonists, the Christie Minstrels, and others. A songbook followed in 1848, Foster's Ethiopian Melodies, which featured the hit Nelly Was a Lady. Foster was not solely a composer of blackface music, but this genre was a significant aspect of his work, and many of his songs associated with blackface are the ones we still hear and even learn as children today. His approach to this genre is the subject of an ongoing debate amongst scholars concerning his racial attitudes, and these songs obviously were the ones that mattered most to Martin Delaney and Joshua Simpson. The story goes that after a string of blackface hits, Foster began to see himself as an innovator of the genre through his success in turning his songs away from the purely risque and vulgar tendencies of other songs performed for the minstrel stage. In a May 25, 1852 letter, he wrote to the minstrel impresario E.P. Christie. He put it this way: "I find that by my efforts I have done a great deal to build up a taste for the Ethiopian songs among refined people by making the words suitable to their taste, instead of the trashy and really offensive words which belong to some songs of that order." End quote. Part of this building up of the genre was done by his song's mix of blackface and sentimental tropes, giving black figures at the center of his songs an interior life and imbuing them with pathos, primarily through a nostalgic longing for home. This understanding of Foster's music stands as compelling evidence for those who would argue that Foster was, despite his involvement with a racist cultural phenomenon, racially progressive. Foster's brother Morrison, who took great pains to shape Stephen's legacy after his death and after the Civil War, writes, quote, "In these two songs," and he's talking about O Susanna and Uncle Ned, "Stephen showed his intuitive knowledge of Negro melody and pathos. He founded a new era in melody and ballad. The grotesque and clownish aspect of Negro songs was softened, and ridicule began to merge into sympathy." End quote. This understanding of Foster's music as, yes, participating in racialized ugliness, but more importantly, conveying the interiority of black characters, is one of two prominent threads of this conversation.
As anti-slavery feeling arose in the North, songs like Stephen Foster's sentimental Uncle Ned and the popular Nellie Gray and Nicodemus the Slave were regarded not only as entertainment, but as descriptions of actual happenings. "There was an old brother and his name was Uncle Ned, and he died long ago, long ago. And he had no wool on the top of his head in the place where the wool ought to grow. Then lay down the shovel and the hoe, hang up the fiddle and the bow. For there's no more work for poor old Ned. He's gone where the good brothers go."
Burl Ives, in a recuperative mode, aligning Foster misleadingly with the rise of anti-slavery sympathizers, replacing certain N and D words with brother, extending the familial theme. Simpson would answer this song with one of his own titled The Slaveholder's Rest, a fantasy where the death of the enslaved person becomes that of the enslaver. And Delaney would include it in the New Orleans section of Blake when Henry encounters a group plotting an uprising. "Hang up the shovel and the hoe, I don't care whether I work or no. Old master's gone to the slaveholder's rest, he's gone where they all ought to go." The sublime musing about Ned in Foster's song might imbue this figure with humanity, but it is a static view of the situation. Ned is merely part of the spatial configuration, not much different from the shovel and the hoe. The slaveholder's death in Simpson's song, set to the tune of Uncle Ned, prompts a similar sublime reflection on the significance of how this death will shape the lives of the enslaved. But the death is a good thing, an event of cosmic justice that will positively change the lives of the enslaved, and as the singer declares, our blood will cease to flow. The sentimental aesthetic orientation continues to factor heavily into the contours of current debates concerning Foster's racial attitudes. To some, this perspective contradicted prevailing notions about the mere fungibility of the enslaved population by ascribing wants, needs, and desires to the figures featured in the songs. For James Baldwin, however, writing a century later about Uncle Tom's Cabin, in comments that could easily be applied to Foster's songs, such a posture was a, quote, ostentatious parading of excessive and spurious emotion that obscured the secret and violent inhumanity, the mask of cruelty maintained by a society structured by enslavement. More recently, scholars have turned away from seeing these songs as evidence of racial progress. Jenny Lightwise Goff, for example, argues against those who would see Foster's deployment of sentimental tropes as evidence of an evolution in his racial thinking, identifying this trend as a misleading conversion narrative, arguing that the sympathies Foster incites actually efface the very real racial differences and inequalities at the very root of U.S. society. Put more succinctly, Lightwise Goff writes, quote, "The sympathetic representation can hide as much pain as it reveals." Furthermore, Christopher Lynch argues that the songwriter, perpetually in debt, ultimately aspired to an early kind of pop music universality that responded to market, not progressive, forces. Martin Delaney's Blake and Joshua Simpson's original anti-slavery songs take up and scrutinize the kind of sentimental aesthetic that Foster fused with blackface minstrelsy. Additionally, Blake is itself an extended critique of the kind of sentimentalist aesthetic marshaled so effectively by Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, the ur-text of abolitionist sentimentality. Not incidentally, this novel also inspired Foster's highly successful sentimental plantation idol, My Old Kentucky Home. In the year Uncle Tom's Cabin appeared as a book, and Foster wrote to E.P. Christie to assert his accomplishments in ushering Ethiopian melodies into the middle-class parlor, Simpson and Delaney riffed on and altered the individualizing experience of these bourgeois sentiments in order to summon an anti-slavery collective. In the preface to original anti-slavery songs, Simpson outlines a strategy similar to Foster's, and for that matter Stowe's, writing, quote, "My object in my selection of tunes is to kill the degrading influence of those comic Negro songs, which are too common among our people, and change the flow of those sweet melodies into more appropriate and useful channels." Playing on the tension between the normative domesticity implied by sentimentalism and the bodiness of minstrelsy, Simpson extends abolitionism into the quintessential site of sentimental gesture, the home, where he hoped, as he writes in the preface, his music would, quote, "find its way and lodging place in every house and family in the land of the free and the home of the brave." In their uses of Foster's melodies, Delaney and Simpson are up to something different from other abolitionist uses of so-called Ethiopian songs. Similar to white abolitionists, they strategize ways to reorient popular culture around anti-slavery. However, the meanings engendered by the aesthetics of feeling are more slippery, and their relationship to concrete anti-slavery actions is more closely entwined. Through these musical references, Simpson and Delaney make what Eric Lott has described as, quote, "guerrilla appropriations that inscribe black agency back into history through blackface songs taken back from those who had plundered black cultural practices." An important example of this use of the sentimental register occurs just before Blake hears the New Orleans insurrectionists sing Simpson's parody of Uncle Ned. When Blake first makes his way to the levees along the Mississippi River and hears the songs of the boatmen. In this scene, Blake listens to the performance of Simpson's song, The Sun's Reflections. This one is set to the tune of Foster's Old Folks at Home. To refresh your memory, Foster's song goes, "Way down upon the Suwannee River, far, far away, that's where my heart is turning ever, that's where the old folks stay." You know the song. Simpsons goes, "Way down upon the Mobile River, close to Mobile Bay, there's where my thoughts is running ever, all through the livelong day. There I've a good and fond old mother, though she is a slave. There I've a sister and a brother, lying in their peaceful graves." Like with A Way to Canada and The Slaveholder's Rest, we hear a change in Foster's original conceit. Whereas Foster's song ventures an idealized and rather vague nostalgia for the plantation, Simpson's lyrics refocus our attention on the dysfunction of enslaved family life. With Foster's song, we hear a conventional longing desire for a broken home to be made whole, an importation of the sentimental genre that signified, as Eric Lott has argued, a, quote, "condensed, fortuitous mapping of white desire in dark skin." Simpson's singer attempts to forestall the escape into wistful nostalgia that structures the magical thinking at the heart of Foster's song by insisting that we meditate not on idyllic youthful moments, but on the brute facts of the suffering mother who he has left and the brother and sister lying in their peaceful graves. Stock sentimental figures, to be sure, but ones that attempt to close the gaps between Foster's vague nostalgia and the actual precarity of enslaved life. With Delaney's use of this material in his novel, we witness a further twist, as his main character, Henry Blake, hears the song and recoils at its sentimentality. Initially captivated by the, quote, "pathos of delicate tenderness, which is but a spray from the stream which gushed out in insuppressible jets from the agitated fountains of their souls," end quote, the boatman's performance of Simpson's song incites Henry to continue his revolutionary mission with more vigor, rather than immersing himself within the morass of sentimental experience regarding the dissolution of the family in the song. The poignancy of the boatman's song, while compelling him to press on, misaligns with Henry's project of fomenting a grand insurrection, a general strike. Delaney's and Simpson's uses of Foster's sentimentalist-inflected minstrel music offers an intriguing outgrowth of what sociologist John Cruise has identified as the ethno-sympathy that structured the emergence of African-American music in the 19th century. By this, he means the shift in perception of African-American music as engendering a kind of sympathy with white listeners. Building on the shifts that caused enslaved noises to be perceived as musical expressions, the music of these writers is directly politically engaged in the resistance to enslavement, capable of forging collectives and producing change in the world, and it prompts a reevaluation of the origins of early African American music as not simply reporting on the horrors of enslavement. The scene in the New Orleans chapters of Blake illustrates how Delaney and Simpson were complicating these kinds of expressions. Instead of continuing to listen to what the boatmen sing, Henry Blake begins to focus on ways to deploy music as an organizational tool of his revolutionary perspective, going to a meeting of insurrectionists in New Orleans, and eventually moving his operation to Cuba in the second part of the novel, where he returns to music in the form of the anthem, as he rallies his supporters for the pending revolution. In her insightful definition, Shana Redmond describes the 20th century Black anthem as a set of musical forms and a set of organizing strategies within Black movement cultures, bound together by African-derived performance techniques, Western art traditions, attachments to social justice organizations, iconic performers and performances, relationships to exile, and collective visions of freedom. She continues, "They take with them myriad histories and struggles that both ground and invent the audience's relationship to their socio-political present." The formations Redmond identifies with the 20th century Black anthem are inchoate in Delaney's and Simpson's uses of music, even if they partly emerge from the contradictory space of an antebellum society structured in racism. At the end of Blake, Delaney once again riffs on a song by Joshua Simpson. This time, it's not one that deploys a Stephen Foster melody, but one that appropriates Samuel Francis Smith's My Country, 'Tis of Thee. Delaney adapts Simpson's song to his novel's circumatlantic theme by specifying Cuba for Simpson's America as the dark land of slavery the reader, the listener, the singer should condemn and organize against. I close with a shape note rendition of the song titled Song of the Aliened American, sung with Simpson's lyrics.
Thank you for listening. We are a production of C19, the Society of 19th Century Americanists. If you enjoyed this episode or have thoughts, use the hashtag C19podcast on Twitter or get in touch with us at c19podcast@gmail.com. Have an idea for an episode? For details on submitting a proposal, check out our CFP on the C19 website.